When you look at the global economic scoreboard, there's this one number that really causes governments to sweat. It's the current account deficit. It's basically that flashing red light on the dashboard that tells a country, hey, you are spending way more money abroad than you are earning, and that hole is getting bigger.
It's a measure of imbalance, really, and it drives these huge, high-stakes political decisions about taxes, interest rates, even the value of your currency.
Exactly. And often those choices just don't work the way the textbooks say they should.
Right, which can lead to, a lot of protracted pain and struggle. So today, we're taking a deep dive into the source material to give you the shortcut.
Our mission today is to get you fluent in this critical metric. So to start, let's unpack this balance. When we talk about the current account, it's a part of the overall balance of payments, the BOP. But what's actually in it? Because it's not just about container ships full of goods.
That's the crucial distinction. We are measuring all non-financial transactions between one country and, well, the rest of the world over a period of time. You can kind of break it down into two main buckets. The first one's the easy one, the actual trade in goods and services. So exports minus imports.
Right. So if we're exporting software services and importing iPhones, that all goes in the first bucket.
Exactly. The second bucket, and this is the one that's often forgotten, deals with income and transfers. This includes something called investment income, which is the credit your citizens earn on assets they hold abroad, minus the interest payments you owe to foreigners on their investments in your country.
Okay, so a two-way street.
The two-way street. And finally, you have unrequited transfers. Think of things like remittances sent home by workers overseas or foreign aid payments. Summing up those four categories gives you the CA balance.
That second bucket, the investment income one, that feels really crucial, especially for the US, as I'm sure we'll see later.
It is. And when we assess a country's economic health, we always look at that balance relative to the country's size. The main metric economists use is the CA to GDP ratio.
CA over GDP.
If that ratio is negative, you have a deficit. For context, the U.S. CAD GDP was estimated to be around 4% in 2024-2025. You also measure how integrated a country is globally through something called trade openness.
Which is just exports plus imports over GDP.
That's it. And for smaller, really globalized economies like Vietnam or Singapore, that ratio often goes way over 100%.
Okay, so a deficit means a country is essentially living beyond its global means, spending more than it produces. And this gap, it has to be financed somehow.
It has to be.
So what are the root causes that the source material points to? What pushes a country into this position?
Well, the first factor is just pure economic momentum. We call it national income variation, or maybe a better term is economic overheating. If a country is booming, experiencing rapid economic growth compared to its trading partners, that newfound wealth means people just have a greater demand for goods and services.
And domestic supply can't keep up.
It can't keep up. So that demand just spills over into imports. And economic expansion in the U.S., for instance, has a direct, almost mechanical effect. It sucks in imports and widens the deficit.
Okay, so growth can be a problem. What's next?
The second factor is all about price competitiveness. This is where inflation comes in. If your country has higher local inflation than your trading partners, what we call CPI differentials, your goods become more expensive.
Both at home and abroad.
Both at home and abroad, It erodes your competitiveness. Imports rise, exports fall. You just lose market share because your prices are too high.
And the third factor deals with consumption habits and government debt, often leading to that dreaded term twin deficits.
Yes, they're highly correlated. We see that large domestic private consumption when it's combined with large public consumption, so government deficits.
Right, everyone's spending too much.
Everyone is spending too much, and it drives that economic overheating. You almost inevitably get the twin deficits, the fiscal deficit, and the resulting current account deficit.
And beyond those organic economic forces, governments actively use artificial measures to try and shift the balance, right? Which is the fourth factor.
Absolutely. The government restrictions. The most common one is a tariff, which is just a tax on imported goods.
The idea being you make imports more expensive so people buy fewer of them.
Theoretically, yes. It should lower domestic demand for them, which improves the CA balance. And we've seen the U.S. use tariffs on everything from steel and solar panels to specific farm goods.
And the sources mention one particularly vivid example of how serious these can get, the banana war.
It sounds a bit absurd, but it is massive.
Yeah.
The U.S. imposed sanctions, I think it was around $191 million, on Europe because of European restrictions on banana exports.
Just goes to show these aren't small disputes.
Not at all. It underscores that trade restrictions, whether they're tariffs or non-tariff barriers like health norms, quotas, subsidies, they are high-stakes policy tools used explicitly to manipulate that trade balance.
Okay, so once a country recognizes it has this persistent deficit problem, it has to decide how to fix it. If the core problem is that the economy is overheated and consuming too much, what levers do they pull?
The overarching goal is pretty simple in theory. You have to reduce absorption, which is just the total spending by residents, and increase national savings.
So cool the economy down.
Cool it down. And that usually requires some pain. They start with the most direct, high-impact options. Tight money and tight budgets.
Monetary and fiscal tools.
Exactly. On the monetary side, that's tight policy.
Yeah.
Higher interest rates, maybe raising bank reserve requirements. It makes borrowing more expensive, which cools down private consumption and investment.
And on the fiscal side?
It's higher taxes and immediate cuts to government spending.
Which is politically lethal in any democracy. I mean, cutting spending and hiking taxes is a recipe for losing the next election.
It really is.
Yeah.
And that leads to the risk we mentioned. You could kill economic growth entirely. If you reduce private consumption and shrink public spending too quickly, you could plunge the country right into a recession while trying to fix the current account.
So that's the tightrope.
It is. And that's why policymakers also look at longer-term structural reforms, the trade and production tools. This means boosting competitiveness by focusing on technology, improving productivity.
And also finding new markets, new things to sell.
Right. Trade diversification and, critically, import substitution.
Import substitution, so actively trying to produce at home what you currently import, often with subsidies or incentives.
It's a huge structural shift. We've seen this strategy highlighted by leaders like Milei in Argentina, who focus intensely on these microeconomic reforms to change what the country produces and consumes over the long term.
But if all that tightening is so painful, there's got to be another way. And this brings us to the tool that gets the most attention, the exchange rate.
The exchange rate adjustment.
Okay, so let's talk about the textbook remedy, devaluation. On paper, it's just beautiful. Your currency weakens, foreign goods immediately become more expensive, so you import less.
And at the same time, your goods become cheaper for foreign buyers, which should boost exports.
Theoretically, the deficit just shrinks, and fast. But here's where the sources show us the real-world friction. This is far from a silver bullet.
Very far. The intended impact that higher import prices will reduce demand is often, well, muted. First off, foreign exporters are rarely passive.
They don't just sit there.
They don't.
Yeah.
If your currency weakens by, say, 10%, they might choose to reduce their own profit margins by 5% to keep their price competitive in your market. And just like that, they've nullified half the effect.
They'd rather sacrifice some margin to maintain that crucial market share.
Absolutely. And then the competitive race starts. If your currency weakens, why wouldn't other competing nations weaken theirs to stay competitive? You could end up in this spiral of weakness with no net gain for anyone.
And then there's the lag.
A massive time lag. International trade often operates on contracts set months in advance, so consumption patterns can't shift overnight. In the U.S., the lag before you feel the full impact of a currency change is often cited as 18 months or more.
18 months. And what about the impact of these huge global supply chains?
That's arguably the biggest friction point. Intracompany trade, you know, where a multinational corporation ships components between its own subsidiaries across borders.
Is highly resistant to currency fluctuations.
It is. The source material says this kind of captive trade accounts for half of all international trade. And up to 60% of European exports are actually intra-European transactions. When trade is internal to a company, currency shifts don't really change the underlying costs.
That structural reality just completely negates the idea of a quick currency fix. And this resistance, it leads us to one of the most famous shapes in economics, the J-curve phenomenon.
The J-curve. It illustrates the actual painful time path of adjustment. So when a currency is devalued, the domestic currency cost of your existing import contracts immediately shoots up.
Right, because you already agreed to pay, say, 1 million euros, and now each euro costs you more dollars.
Exactly. But the volume of imports hasn't changed yet. So the trade balance temporarily dips deeper into deficit. That's the bottom of the J.
So things actually get worse before they get better.
They get worse. It's a short-term worsening of the problem. Only after some time, sometimes a year or more, as consumers finally shift away from those expensive foreign goods and new export contracts get signed, does the balance slowly recover and begin to move toward a surplus.
So you have to be prepared to ride out that initial worsening. And whether you even get that recovery depends entirely on the price sensitivity of the goods being traded. We're talking about elasticities here.
Exactly. The Marshall-Lerner conditions. They basically state that a devaluation will only improve the trade balance if the combined price elasticities of your imports and exports are greater than one.
So if the stuff you buy and sell is really sensitive to price changes, like consumer goods, it works.
It works beautifully. But if you're importing essential, incompressible goods like crude oil or specific industrial metals, a price increase won't stop demand, and the devaluation just makes your total import bill more expensive.
In that case, devaluation is futile, maybe even damaging.
It could be. And when we talk about competitiveness, we really need to move beyond simple nominal numbers. To truly assess and boost your export performance, a country has to look at the real effective exchange rate, or REOR.
What makes the real effective exchange rate so much more important than the nominal rate we see on the news ticker?
Well, the nominal rate is just the price of the dollar in terms of the euro, for example.
Hmm.
The REOR takes that nominal rate, adjusts it for inflation differences between your country and your trading partners.
Okay, so it accounts for prices?
It accounts for prices, and then it weights it against a basket of currencies of your major trading partners. That inflation adjustment is critical. If your country's inflation is rampant, any nominal devaluation is immediately wiped out in real terms. The REOR tells you your true long-term trade competitiveness.
And to make this a bit more relatable, we have the fun side of economics, Burgernomics.
The Big Mac Index.
The Big Mac Index gives you a real-world snapshot of this, right? It's based on purchasing power parity. Basically, what an identical basket of goods costs in different countries. It's a simple way to grasp if your currency is truly competitive or not.
It is. And now, let's apply this to the structural puzzle of the U.S., which presents this unique paradox. For over four decades, since 1980, the U.S. has had a structural dilemma. Its total investment has consistently outpaced its total savings.
And that structural gap must be balanced by a continuous current account deficit.
It has to be. That's the core engine of the U.S. deficit right there.
Oh.
And this creates the financing dilemma. To shrink the CA deficit, you need a weaker dollar to curb imports.
But to finance that very deficit, which you have to do, you need to attract foreign capital, which requires a strong dollar.
It's a total tightrope walk. The U.S. needs foreign capital inflows, cited in the sources as roughly $2 billion per day, just to finance this gap. And historically, attempts to weaken the dollar to close the trade deficit have often failed.
Why?
Because of a phenomenon called incomplete pass-through. The currency movement just doesn't fully transmit to price changes for the consumer.
And why is the U.S. so resistant to this change?
There are three main reasons the data points to. First, the special central role of the U.S. dollar in invoicing international trade. So much global trade is just priced in U.S. dollars, regardless of where the goods are made.
So even if the euro strengthens against the dollar, the price a U.S. importer pays for, say, oil, often doesn't change immediately because the oil is priced in dollars to begin with.
Exactly. Second, foreign exporters are strategically absorbing the depreciation into their profit margins to maintain their market share in the lucrative U.S. market.
Ah, so the European luxury car maker would rather take a hit on profits than risk losing their foothold in New York or L.A.
They eat the cost, and the American consumer never sees the full impact of the currency shift. And third, U.S. marketing, shipping, distribution costs are really high.
Domestic costs.
Right. Domestic costs denominated in dollars that are added to the import price after the goods enter the country. These high domestic costs just reduce the share of the final price that's actually affected by the exchange rate. Data from the mid-2000s showed only about half of the dollar's depreciation was ever actually passed through to higher U.S. import prices.
Wow. That makes the whole policy landscape look incredibly complicated. Let's look at how this plays out in the real world. Let's review some global case studies who succeeded in adjusting and who continues to struggle.
Well, Vietnam is often held up as a success story. They managed this impressive feat of adjusting from a staggering deficit of 12% of GDP in the 1990s down to a surplus of 6% by 2025.
That is a massive turnaround.
Not just through the exchange rate, but through massive sustained efforts in trade liberalization, attracting foreign investment, and big structural improvements in productivity. They actively sought out diversification.
But then you have countries facing these structural challenges that make this adjustment much, much harder, particularly those dependent on commodities.
Right. Take Chile. Its trade balance is just so heavily influenced by global copper prices, which are notoriously volatile. If copper prices drop, No amount of short-term fiscal tightening can fully offset that plunge in export receipts.
Which forces a painful peso devaluation.
Almost necessitates it.
Yeah.
And Mexico has similar issues, even though oil makes up a smaller portion of its exports.
Right, I saw that. Oil is only about 8% of Mexico's export receipts, but it's 20% of its federal budget revenues.
Exactly. So when oil prices swing, it hits both the external balance, the CA, and the internal balance, the fiscal deficit, dramatically. It's hard to fix one without fixing the other.
We've also seen historical examples like Greece, which ran enormous deficits for decades, showing it was a structural imbalance, not just simple overheating.
Greece ran up huge deficits from the 1980s onward, and their structural issues were compounded by their inability to use their own exchange rate as a tool once they joined the Eurozone.
They lost that flexibility.
They lost the flexibility of devaluation. So the only painful path left was internal devaluation cutting wages and prices, which resulted in a deep, prolonged recession.
Okay, let's circle back one last time to the financing element, particularly for the U.S. deficit. Who is footing that $2 billion a day bill?
Capital inflows, largely from Asian central banks. As long as countries like China, Korea, and Japan run these large trade surpluses, they need a safe place to park that money. And U.S. government assets, the dollar zone, remain the destination of choice.
So there's a kind of symbiosis there.
There is. An essential insight from a source is telling. As long as Asia stays in the dollar zone, the dollar cannot crash. The funding risk exists, but for now, the U.S. continues to attract the capital it needs.
So what does this all mean for you, the well-informed listener?
Well, we've seen that adjusting a current account deficit is a really complex balancing act. You're choosing between two difficult paths.
One path is tightening fiscal and monetary policy, which risks killing your domestic growth and causing political unrest.
And the other path is adjusting the exchange rate, which is slow, it's incomplete because of global supply chains and dollar invoicing, and it's highly dependent on those crucial Marshall-Lerner elasticity conditions.
The global trade system itself seems to actively resist these simple textbook fixes. The J-curve is that powerful reminder that short-term pain is an unavoidable part of the process.
And the special status of the dollar creates these unique friction points that other currencies just don't face.
So, as a final thought,
let's consider the long-term structural risk in the U.S. position. Since 1980, the U.S. has been relying on a large capital account surplus attracting massive foreign investment to finance its trade deficit. This makes the U.S. a persistent net borrower from the rest of the world.
And that massive, decades-long inflow of foreign capital means that eventually, large investment income payments will be due abroad.
Exactly. The investment income surplus the U.S. currently enjoys may eventually be eroded by this growing debt burden, which will, ironically, worsen the current account deficit over time, regardless of what happens to trade. That structural shift in future debt servicing,
yeah,
that's the next big economic wave to watch.